there's a lot that can fall under the umbrella of private money lending. Family member with a little extra cash on hand, a physician or a nurse that wants to get a little extra capital. And then there's the business of private money lending. And this is where you guys were moving into the space. You guys lend bank money. So do you want to talk about note-on-note financing?
If you want to be a big box private money lender, which is called as hard money lender, because private money is small money, hard money is big money when you play in that space.
Welcome to Nursing Real Wealth. Today, I'm excited to have Chai and Prakash, who transitioned as engineers within the oil and gas industry to successful real estate investors and lenders. With over 10 years of experience in real estate and 100 plus single family homes in their portfolio, they're now focusing on growing their lending business. Chai and Prakash have become incredible mentors to me and to my partner, and I would like to welcome them to the show. Chai and Prakash, great to have you on.
Hey, good to be here, man.
Yeah, absolutely.
Excited to be here.
Let's go ahead and start with, I want to tap into this transition that you made from oil and gas into real estate. They sound like very different fields, but obviously you were able to manage that transition. How did your W-2 shape that path into real estate, and what motivated the shift? Because, you know, most people look at that as a fairly lucrative career.
We both are engineering background, and I think, you know, a lot of people getting into real estate, you might hear them, hey, I want to quit as soon as possible. But I think we thought differently. We leveraged our W-2 so that we could grow our real estate business. And I think we quit when we started losing money because of our W-2. So we maxed out all our loans. And our careers were good. We both loved engineering. We were in the supply chain. I was in oil and gas. And Chai was in Schlumberger, right, Chai? We had no... It's not that we didn't hate our jobs. We wanted to have our own business. And real estate is something that was exciting for us. And that, you know, we balanced it well for the first almost seven years that we were... We started a real estate business, and then we eventually transitioned fully into real estate. That was like 3 years back, a little bit more than three.
Mm-hmm. Did you guys know each other before you transitioned into real estate, or did you meet in this journey into real estate?
We knew each other before.
Through common friends. So for going from W-2 to real estate was one of the reasons why I chose to stay in my W-2 is, I mean, two reasons, but main reason is one for immigration reasons, because I needed my visa and all these things. But it also, until your passion, your business becomes self-sustainable and you are not dependent on that business, until it becomes sustainable, you don't want to be dependent on it, because when you are dependent on it, your livelihood is dependent on it, then the stress can come in the way of growth of that business. So until that happened, and also the third more of a hidden reason or hidden thought behind that was that I don't want to go from one W-2 to another stressful situation. I mean, there are a lot of funny reels about this. People talk about like, oh yeah, I went from 9 to 5 to 24/7. So although we do work 24/7, but that's more passion project than anything else. It's not that we have to work 24/7 now, but if we did quit our W-2 early on, then it would have gone in that direction. So
it would have been working 24/7 in order to make ends meet.
And because there was another income coming in, my attitude in the job was also very different. I didn't have to worry about what people think. I didn't have to stay under the radar. I could speak my mind. I could do things I liked. So because I was not dependent on the job or my business at the same time. So it was a win-win situation from both sides.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Prakash, you mentioned something that was, I think, really key. You said something along the lines of not to quit your job until you realize that you're losing money because you have the job. Do you want to expound a little bit more on that metric and how you determine, okay, now I see that I'm losing money because I have a job?
So, you know, this was back in 2020, that time frame when, you know, we were, I think, 6-7 years into real estate. You know, you can almost call it full time because, you know, even that's what we had in our mind when we were doing our W-2s, right? How to buy the next house, how to, you know, get a next flip. And, you know, there came a point where we had, you know, few VAs, we had acquisition agent, and our job was really coming in our way of growing. We were limited to time. We couldn't go for appointments and our salaries were more than replaced, right? We also were, there's one goal we had is to max out the loans that we get, the Fannie Freddie loans that we get, which is we get like 10, right, before you, on your W-2, before you have to go to DSCR. So we maxed all of those out, almost all of them out. And then we had a team, we had a consistent flow. But at that point, we were stuck, right? We hit the ceiling and we were like, hey, we cannot grow our business. We were feeling it that the opportunities are there, but we are not able to grab them. So it was a little bit, it was easier to quit because we know we are going up from there instead of stressing out and thinking, oh, now the paycheck's not going to come. So it was a very smooth transition. And I think we almost doubled the amount of business we did after we quit our jobs.
So I want to tell people who are thinking about switching from their W-2 to full-time entrepreneur career of any sort in real estate or anywhere else. First of all, I'm more real estate biased because real estate is a lot safer. That's why 90% of the millionaires are made in real estate than anywhere else. You're dealing with tangible assets. You're not dealing with stocks and valuations. So a lot of good things about real estate for sure. But going from W-2 to any entrepreneurial career, for that matter, is 100% always, no matter who you are, is going to be stressful. Okay. And I can't stress that enough. I feel like people just think that, okay, what they're doing in their W-2, all they have to do is just quit their W-2 and then do it for themselves and things are going to change. They have to be 10 times, I mean, they have to work 10 times more to be considered equal in an entrepreneurial role or when they wear that hat. So things get very difficult before they get better. Okay. So if you are working a W-2 and you're considering switching from W-2 to a career that is going to make you work 10x harder, why not work 9x harder and just keep your W-2? And see if it's cut out for you before you even consider switching. And if it starts working well, then just try to push it until you can and try to reach that breaking point where you actually start losing money, like Prakash said. So unless if you cannot do a side hustle while you have a job, you will not become a better entrepreneur when you quit your job. So that's how it was, in my opinion. It's not I feel like everybody should try the business they want to do as a side hustle before they even commit to it in a way. That makes it a lot safer. It's, it's 10 times better that way.
Yeah, because, you know, a sudden availability of 8-10 hours a day doesn't make the business successful, right? A lot of other things going on, like how you have your network, your deal flow. So unless you are, I think it's easier to stress out doing two jobs than quitting your W-2 and just trying to figure out where the next deal is going to come from. because, you know, real estate does take a lot of investments. If you're buying rental, the cash flow, first few years, there is no cash flow. So you have to build up enough assets and have decent passive income before you can quit.
People say, I mean, I would say myself that when I started, things were very different. I could buy a house in Texas and it will cash flow almost guaranteed. Things are not different now because interest rates have gone up and taxes have gone up, insurance. But things are always going to be different. And business, all businesses have to pivot every year, no matter what. Okay. There is always things that will change. There is always someone that will disrupt the market and the rest have to change for better or worse. So if you are not cut out for that, then W-2 is not a bad option. You don't want to live a bad quality life because you're an entrepreneur. I mean, the entrepreneurial life should be, should make your life, I mean, should make you happier. Before it makes you richer, so to say. So a lot of people forget the happiness part while they are focused on getting rich, and that's when they fail. Most people who are successful, I have seen them happier than what they were because it's a passion project for them at the end of the day. So, and trying that while having a W-2 is so much better than quitting W-2. But yeah.
Can you describe that period of time of transition? What was the length of time that you guys were dedicated to these extra hours, working late, pulling, you know, all the stops to make this thing happen? Yeah. What would you describe that length?
I'll tell you about my experience and then Prakash can tell about his. I have wanted to get into a business. I've tried many, many businesses, at least 8 or 9 of them before I stumbled upon real estate. And that was also very accidental. But before I came to America, I had this small piece of land my family owned for a long, long time. And I wanted to do something about it. And I ran into issues with local politicians. And we were, I mean, nobody compared to where they were, and in India, I mean, things are very different. So that's how I ended up coming to America in the first place. But real time frame started around 2014. So Prakash and I had a business in 2012, and we shut that down around 20. We shut that down like in a year and a half or so, or even less than that, if I remember. But that was a business based on IT services, and then we ran into some real issues with that. So entrepreneur career wise, I mean, I would say I have been at it for a lot longer than 10 years, but I just never found something that I really liked or I could commit to. But when I came across real estate in 2014, which is when I was really just trying to buy a property in a decent growing area that will pay for itself. I didn't even know the concept of cash flow. I didn't even think cash flow existed because where I come from, I invested like first when I got a W-2 job in America, I invested a lot of money back home in India and bought a piece of property that's probably worth like 150, 170 grand in American dollars. And even as of today, the total rent is less than $500. And my payment on that property is almost $1,000. I mean, if I own it cash, but if I were to get a loan on it, the loan interest rate in India is so much higher. So for me, the concept of cash flow never existed in my life at all until someone literally handheld me all the way and put me in this seminar. That seminar showed me how to buy discounted properties. And I was like oh my God, this is possible. I didn't think it was possible. I thought I just found out a secret from someone. So that was the game changer in 2015 when I attended that seminar in Houston, Texas. There is a organization called Lifestyles Unlimited. So I attended that seminar and then I came across all these ideas how to buy properties through wholesalers. That's when everything changed. So that's when I decided, I still had not committed to real estate as a full-time business because I was still, it was still a foreign thing for me. I wasn't, now, I mean, the way we buy properties, sometimes we don't even go look at them. And I mean, we are so comfortable with the whole idea of real estate. But back then it was not like that. So at that time, I just wanted to build a rental portfolio and then see how things go. So I bought a few properties from wholesalers and I realized how they make a wholesale assignment fee. And that's when I decided to do it on my own. So I started doing wholesaling on my own. And I was telling Prakash about it at that time. And I was like, this is like, we can't tell anybody. This is so cool. Like, and then there was also other education at that time, MLS scraping, and he'll talk about that. He was going through another route and we had not even like started a partnership until after 2018, mid 2018. So 3 years we were just going on our own. I was buying properties, wholesaling, flipping, dabbling. So there was no reason to even think about quitting the job. And at that time, that didn't even cross my mind. In fact, I even accepted positions overseas. I'm so lucky that it didn't quite work out. I mean, think market took a different direction and that I didn't move out of America. So a lot of things could have happened that didn't happen, for better or worse. I mean, mostly for better. But and then after 2018, when we started this partnership, we started buying up a lot of properties. And after that, we were 100% committed to real estate. And then we went from wholesaling to rentals to wraps to lending and all kinds of things after. But that has been the journey. So it took literally 5-6 years to commit and then another 5 years before I quit my job. So it's a long process. I mean, if you are not there to enjoy the ride, don't even try. Like, it's not going to happen tomorrow, guaranteed.
So my, you know, there was a good, you know, me and Chai started up around similar 2015. I went to the same seminar where I think he went to that seminar and he told me that was good. I think I went in like 2 weeks of that seminar, like, okay, let me go check it out. Back then it was, I think, $400 or $500. And I'm like, damn, it's a lot of money. But I still went, spent 2 full days there. It was, I mean, 500, we still made decent paychecks, but giving 500, you know, you're not, I don't even know what I was getting into, right? So, exactly. Yeah, we had nobody around us who had done well, right? It was like, it would be like, Justin, you calling me and, hey, you want to attend this seminar on nursing, right? I would not know anything, right? That's how it, a new real estate, but it was still like, okay, I'll go figure it, like learn what's going on. And it was, you know, it was an eye opener how United States has, you know, the financing, right? It's, real estate is more about financing here. How creative you can get, you know, you got creative loans like sub twos and all the loan products that you have here. That was an eye opener for me, that initially, you know, we thought like, hey, get a house and that's it. That's one house that we live in all our life. That's what our parents did back home. They're still living in the same house for the last 20, 30 years. And so, and then I enjoyed the transition, right? I think that was the best time, where I see a lot of new people struggling or regretting, or either they hate real estate or hate their W-2. But I think I, even though it was, I wouldn't even call it hard work, because it was hard work, but it was fun. It's everything that we enjoyed. So I think my first rental was right in within 2 weeks of that class. And my broker who helped me buy the first deal, he's still doing multifamily. He has around $4,000 to $5,000. He's a multifamily. And that's when I'm like, it looks interesting. I still have that first house around 9 years and the same tenant. Still the same tenant. It's been amazing. The son who was, I think was 10, 11 back then, now he's paying for the rent. It's amazing. Like it's the second generation living, and they've been living in that house since 2009. I've asked them so many times, you should buy this house, right? It's like almost, they are 16 years in that house, something crazy. I haven't been to that property for last, I would say 4 or 5 years. They are the property managers and they are also my tenants. Well, it's fortunately, right? The first experience was really good. That's when, you know, then I started doing MLS scraping. And then 2018 is when Hurricane Ike hit. It was Ike, right, Chai? 2018, or it was 17 is a Hurricane Harvey hit. That's when there was a lot of flooding. And then we thought about, let's do some postcards or whatnot, right? Try to get that. That's how we started. I still have that first picture when all our families packed the first postcards. As a company, like Step Up Investments, we were packing, we had our first kid. So that's where our journey as a partnership started. And then, you know, it's been every 6 months. I tell people, you know, people in W2, people are used to doing the same. I did the same exact thing for the last 5 years with small changes in my W2. But in real estate, every 6 months, we are talking of a new strategy and trying to go in different direction. So if people don't like changing that, don't like doing that, you know, it's real estate is going to be challenging, right? Like we are doing lending now. We've almost done everything in single family space. Now we are also lending since last year, December. And that's what now we are focusing on growing in that direction.
Yeah. Yeah. Before we get deep into the lending side, which I really want to unpack with you guys. I'm curious, and I would love to hear how you scaled up to the 100 single family homes, because you say that journey started in about 2020. Is that correct?
2018.
Oh, 2018. Okay, gotcha. So about 6 years, you bought 100 homes. A lot of people would look at that and be like, well, how in the world did you do that? So I know there's plenty of investors out there that understand how that could happen. But for those that are listening that may not have been exposed to this, how did you get to 100 single family homes in just 6 years?
So when, yeah, go ahead. No, I was saying that when we first started, we started with the whole, so just a small background story before that. So when I first started buying properties from wholesalers, when I was introduced to that concept of wholesalers and discounted properties, I was amazed. Because this is not possible in the world where I come from. Okay. So that was already amazing to me that I can buy a property at 80% value. And then the person that is selling it to me got it at a 70% value, and they are making a fee, sometimes a 10 grand or 10%, depending on the value. But that concept, was so amazing that we started our partnership with the wholesaling as a strategy for acquisition. So we didn't start buying up properties on the market or from other wholesalers, which is what most people do. So we took on a bigger adventure, so to say. Okay. So while people think reaching to 100 properties is difficult, and the answer is yes, it is. The main thing about that is, or any like every time you see a bigger success, the whole idea behind that has something creative involved in it, like creative idea involved in it. So our creativity at that time was using wholesaling as an acquisition technique. Now, I just want to explain for 1 second what wholesaling does when you start using that as an acquisition strategy, not as a business. Okay. A lot of people use wholesaling or wholesaling is their business. They buy and sell. They don't even buy properties, right? Wholesalers are the people who get a property under contract with a seller and then sell that piece of paper. Okay. Most wholesalers, 99% wholesalers in America, do just that. They are not in the business of real estate. They are in the business of selling piece of paper, okay, that they have rights to. I mean, using that paper, they have rights to real estate, okay? So, but we got into it to buy properties. We didn't start wholesaling business to wholesale and make fee, because when I make that money, it is an active income. And I already had a W-2. I already have an active income. I'm already paying my share of the taxes. So I don't want that liability. I don't want that burden of taxes. So now when wholesalers buy properties or lock up properties on the market, they lock up below what the normal investors are going to pay in the market. In Texas at that time, investors were willing to pay 80 to 85%. So the wholesalers had to lock these properties at 70 to 75%. Now what 70 to 75% does is, and when I say 70-75% or 80-85%, I'm talking about talking rehab included. So when you lock up a property that is worth 100,000 on the market for 70,000, you have to factor in how much does it take to fix that property to make it worth 100. So if that number is 10 grand, then you're going to lock it up for 70 minus 10 at 60 grand. So when you are all in to any property at 70 to 75%, and then you go to a lender for refinancing that property, you can pull all your money out. Neither of us came from money, okay? Unless Prakash has something hiding somewhere, I don't know. But neither of us come from money. So we had to get creative, okay? So that was our creativity. If we had to start using our money to buy properties, the first 25% down payment would have ended the discussion for another year. Yeah. So first property usually wipes out all the cash reserves when you are starting initial. So you have to get creative. So when you are a businessman, if you are not creative, your business is going to just plateau very quickly, or even worse, it will get wiped out with this whole AI and other things coming up. Okay, so creativity is number one attribute for a successful businessman. So the reason we could go to 100 is because most of our properties are we have zero money out of pocket when we had to, we bought them cash using hard money lenders for a large period of time. And after we had enough cash saved up, we started buying them cash and then refinancing them quickly to pull all our money out and move on from one property to another. And that's how we reached the 100 properties. If we started buying, so there was a lot of groundwork involved. It involved training people to talk to sellers, then us going to meet sellers, negotiate with them, setting the right expectations, lowering their expectations after the negotiation to the level where we can refinance the property and be in it zero out of pocket. Be the owner zero out of pocket. So that is the main key to reach that big 100 number that people are intimidated about. Like once you set that machine, it's going to yield the same result. But setting up that machine is the main key to go faster.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great. Prakash, you guys have an iconic story that I heard at the very first PML mastermind that I went to. It was actually at the meetup before, the day before, where you guys talked about this $1 million assignment fee. And I wonder if you'd be willing to share that story with us.
So that was, you know, all, yeah, that's become very popular, and it's been you know, one hell of a deal, but it's not, you know, it's, so me and Chai, you know, we used to do cold calling. We used to do texting, mailers and PPCs, like all of it. So we had a,
he means VAs.
VAs, but we used to follow up like all the leads that call, and we had one of the, you know, older lady. She was in a good position in Bank of America, both husband and wife, and you know, she back then, I know some reason in, you know, that those first 4 or 5 years, I had a lot of patience with sellers, right? I used to like bug them and call them. But I'd like 10 times, 15 times, I just wanted to make sure, like, in fact, we wanted to make sure that there's no chance they're going to sell. But now I think we've gotten better at qualifying people very quickly. So here's this lady, you know, she had a house, was asking for too much money. And I kept calling her, okay, just show me the house. She was asking for back then $130,000. Needed about $20,000 worth of work, roughly ARV about 170, 180 in that price range. So there's like no meat on the bone, right? There's no money to be made after you pay all the realtor fees. So I go there for an appointment, and she shows up in Bentley. She shows up in a Bentley, doesn't even get out of the car. And her husband walks out, I walk the house, and I try to negotiate, right? They're like, nope, like nothing. And while sitting in the car, they're like, hey, we are headed to Beaumont. It's a town like about 80, 90 miles from Houston. They're going to go look at their multifamily. And that's when we were like, oh, what are you doing with that? They're like, we're going to sell it. So... and that's when, you know, things started going on in our head. I called Chai. Chai has been, he's been, you know, interested in multifamily. He attended those lifestyle courses. So he was good at underwriting those deals. And that's when I think me and Chai connected. He's like, hey, these people have this amazing deal.
So, and that time I had no idea where the property was. I was still very rookie with underwriting multifamily. So we walked up to her Bentley when she was like, okay, you guys want to come with us? And we were like, I mean, what are you looking to get for it? So she gives us this number, and like very random math, I was like, okay, 5 million divided by number of doors came out to be around 44,000. And I was like, oh my God, this is so good. I mean, without even looking up the address, I just randomly said that. And it was the worst price ever, but because of the area, but I didn't know the area. And we had not even been in business that long to know all the areas around Houston.
This was our first full year in real estate as a company. And, you know, it's a very long story. We did a big 1 hour podcast with Brent Daniels about this, because back then we were in his mentorship. So it will take almost all of our time if we start describing step by step. But we basically said yes to everything. We bought their $130,000 house with no meat on the bone, just to prove them. And then after we closed that, I think the same week, they took us to the multifamily. And that year we had made around $40,000 to $45,000 in profit. We just put that entire money as non-refundable the same day we see it. Like no due diligence, basically, other than, you know, what Chai's gut feeling was. And we were just going for the opportunity, right? Like, hey, we want to do this. And we put all the, what we thought is like, okay, we made $45,000, $50,000, everything's going to be gone, worst case.
And again, it goes back to your point of W-2. We could do that because that our families did not depend on that money.
We could take those risks back in that, you know, because we know our family where, you know, we had our paychecks that took care of our family. This is a side hustle that's making money. And we put that $42,000 non-refundable. And long story, right? We lost that money. They came back, renegotiated the deal. It went through, I think, over a good 6 to 9 months before we got our first half of the assignment. We went back in as with one of our partners who bought one of the properties, right? We there was 180 unit, there was 160 unit, and there was one 120 unit. 120 unit, we wholesaled it. 60 unit, we wholesaled it to our partnership and then went back in. And so it was like quite a few transactions, right? And then at the in 2 year mark, when we sold the whole portfolio, I think our assignment combined was $1 million. So it was not like a $1 million. Yeah, and it's a long story short. I think we have broken down that in our...
She started the conversation at 44,000 per door, which was very high for that area. But little did I know about the area. I was supercharged when I saw the 44 grand price. I was like, oh, this got to be the best deal ever. So we just went in, and by the end of it, when everything was said and done, we ended up closing at 22 per door. Literally, we had to negotiate from 44 a door, literally by 50%.
So by 50%.
But you still got a $1 million assignment.
This was all the power of W-2, right? It was because if we didn't have W-2, we would not have put that $42,000. I don't know what would have happened, but we wouldn't have that freedom to just go ahead and take that risk.
I do want to shift gears and get into the meat and potatoes of what you guys are really focused on right now. You guys are really focused on this lending business and building it up. And before we get deep into it, I'm curious, what put your mind on that? What led you to be like, you know what? I think we want to get into this lending space.
So we've been thinking about lending for some time. Chai was doing it, you know, from his money. I think he would do a few deals a year. As a company, we did like a couple, yeah. As a company, we did some lending deals as well. We would buy some, and you know, we'll buy properties cash, and we would also lend money to our buyers to buy them. So we would do a few deals as a lending, but last year, when, you know, every year we were changing, right? We were like, first couple of years we were doing wholesaling. We were focused on wholesaling. Then the second couple of years, Section 8, Airbnbs, wraps. So every year we've been, you know, focusing on different things. But one constant in real estate is lending. Because as the interest rate changes, you know, as an investor, our strategy changes. Sometimes we flip. Right now, there's no cash flow in Texas. So either we flip them or, you know, we wrap them if there's a wrap buyer. So lending is something that excited me for sure, is something that we could scale. And we had the expertise to underwrite the property. I consider underwriting as our, you know, superpower. Like, I can look at a property in Texas, single family, I can quickly underwrite within my head in a matter of a few minutes. And then we have bank relationships. Go ahead, Chai.
No. I was just saying that in real estate, one of our goals is to have a fully vertically integrated company. So we run everything. We have property management in-house. We have construction in-house. We have acquisition in-house. We stop marketing because we get enough deals from wholesalers at a decent price. So that's why we don't have the marketing for properties anymore. And also we want to move out of the single family or family space into maybe multifamily or an acquisition that will bring in a bigger chunk of real estate at a time. So that's why we stopped our marketing. But other than marketing, we want everything to be in-house in one place under one umbrella. So we don't have to depend on anybody for anything. So having like more things under one umbrella just impacts your other businesses in amazing ways that you can't think of right now. So now that lending has become our mainstream business, it is bringing in so many people that don't have experience that want to flip, and then they are open to partnering up with us. So that opportunity never existed for us, right? Because we were never the lenders, like officially. And until we were lending out of pocket, it's not really taking advantage of other people's money, so to say. And when I buy other people's money, I want to say banks in that particular scenario, because lending is only effective and more lucrative if the banks are willing to give you a large sum of money at a lower interest rate that you can deploy in the market at a higher interest rate. So that is the whole game of lending. So the more so than anything else, and yes, we need to pivot every year, and this has been the most difficult year in terms of everything, because everything's getting difficult to get to because of the interest rates. So in that regard, we probably, for better or worse, we got more time this year to focus on lending that we always wanted to. So, but yeah, that I put it that way in a way.
I think to help define private money lending, you know, people do, there's a lot that can fall under the umbrella of private money lending. An old, you know, a family member with, you know, a little extra cash on hand could be a lender to someone on a small scale, you know, a friend to friend, or even just, you know, a physician or a nurse that wants to get a little extra capital, and they lend it on maybe one or two projects a year. And then there's the business of private money lending. And this is where you guys were moving into the space. And you said something really key. It's that, you know, you can't build a business lending off of your own money. You, in order to scale, you have to lend other people's money. And I think that's a really important piece there that, you know, anybody who's newer to the concept of private money lending hasn't processed necessarily right off the bat. And in particular, you guys lend bank money predominantly. So do you want to talk a little bit about note-on-note financing and what that is and how you're utilizing that in your lending business?
So note-on-note financing is really not a foreign thing. And neither is private money lending, okay? But if you, so the communities that we hang out in, like you and I, are very individualistic in a way, because there are a lot of people that are building or just starting out. But there are many communities outside that cater to more established businesses or established entrepreneurs. So in those spaces, bank money or note-on-note financing is not a foreign thing at all. In fact, it is also very competitive space. We are just not in that competition yet. But if you want to go from $0 to $100 million in loan book using individual investors' money, it's going to be literally 100 times harder to do that job. Because even if you found 100 investors that put $1 million in your company, and good luck with that. I mean, today the market is extremely conducive for that environment because the market interest rates are already higher. Okay. So giving away 10% interest to individuals is not really breaking the bank. But until last year, the interest rates in the market were 4-5%. So banks were lending large sums of money at 4% interest rate. Then the value of individual investors' money at 10% diminishes like very quickly, because neither does it have a weight or the attractive interest rate to it, because it is such a small amount at higher interest rate. Who wants that, right? Compared to a bank which is willing to deploy 10, if not 100 million at a time at 5% interest. Today, the banks have gone higher up. So that's why we are even discussing the difference between the two. Otherwise, it is so clear to me that banks is your main go-to entity for to become a private money lender. If you want to be a big box private money lender, which is called as hard money lender, because private money is small money, hard money is big money when you play in that space. We just use private money as a term to lure people in and then charge the same rates. Whereas hard money is the official name in the market for people who play the big game. And they don't have to lure people in because there is so many people out there already. There is no competition in that regard. Between the hard money lenders, yes, there is competition, but everybody pretty much plays by the same rules. And when you have large sums of money pledged to your entity, now, depending on how much access, how much money is left over in that month or that time period or in that moment, you can change your rates up and down. For example, my bank's like current interest rate is around 9%, okay? And we are charging 3 points of origination and about 12.5% average percentage on the money outside. There are a lot of hard money lenders that are charging 1 point and 12% interest rate. If your private money lending business depends on individual person's money, who you are paying 10, 12, in some cases, I've heard of people paying 15% interest to these individuals. You can only, I mean, you can never compete with people that are, or the hard money lenders that are charging 1 point and 12% interest. But when we have banks' money at 9% interest, we can compete with those people because that's the only way the game is played. Okay. And in that scenario, when that note-on-note financing kicks in, what you still need private money or you still need individual investors' money, but not for what you think. You do need blended capital, some investor capital and some bank capital, but not the way you think. You need that money to show the banks that you have robust cash reserves in case things were to go wrong in the marketplace. Because when things go wrong, banks shut down within a heartbeat, but investors still stay with you. So, but depending your entire business on investors is not going to build a business at all. You're not going to have a business at all, in my opinion.
That it's, it's 100% correct. Chai, I think we lost, can you hear us? Oh, I thought you were saying something, but I couldn't hear. No, yeah, that's 100% correct, right? We see a lot where people in communities, people talk about PML and HML, right? I think it's a lot of people like private money, but honestly, I'm seeing people, private money lenders are charging a lot more than hard money lenders, but and do zero due diligence. That's why people love private money lenders. These same private money lenders are paying 13 to 15, 16%. But at the back end, you know, they are not doing a proper due diligence. So if people want to invest, hard money lenders who are backed by banks, right, are the best place to invest your money in because they have processes in place. They're going to check, you know, because if a bank's giving you money, an investor should easily give you money. It's if I had extra money and I was not lending, from what I know now, I would give my money to a hard money lender in a heartbeat, even if it's 2% less than a private money investor, because we see the red tapes that they go through to protect their money.
Because someone who works it is so important what Prakash just said, to note that do not invest your money with individual investors. let those investors go to a hard money lender to get a loan. You as a private investor, put your money, if you want it in a safer invest, if you want a safer place for your money, then invest that money with a hard money lender that is backed by the bank, because their processes are vetted and approved and audited on a regular basis by the banks. Such as us versus...
We have to submit monthly statements to our banks. And the last thing that we want on our books is a foreclosure, because banks do not want to work with lenders who do bad business. There, you know, hard money lenders have, you know, appraisal, all the checks and balances. So we see so many stories these days of private money lenders losing money. You know, as a borrower, everybody wants a private money lender who is not going to do the due diligence, who is not going to do the proper paperwork. But like investing your money to a private money lender is risky unless you have some personal relationships with them. Then it's okay. But as an investor, hard money lender is a very good place and a secure place to invest your money.
So essentially, when you're talking about investing with a hard money lender, so let's just kind of break this down for, say, you guys, right? So you guys could take an investment from somebody. That investment is used as a vehicle to basically get the bank to lend out more or to increase your credit lines with the bank, right? Yeah. And then you're able to lend that money out, and you're able to pay the person who's lending the personal money to you. Yes. You're able to pay them off of the earnings from this arbitraged money from the bank.
Yes.
Yes.
Yep. And the more you're able to get lent out to you, the higher your credit lines are able to go with the bank, correct?
So when we receive money from private individuals, that money is used as a, that money goes into a thing called debt fund, okay, which is regulated by SEC. And then that debt fund is used as a deposit, to raise money from the banks. It's not raising money. I'll take that back. Wrong language. But to leverage banks' money. Banks want deposits as a security to just see how much your business, how liquid your business is. So just to clarify, banks are not using that deposit as a down payment or skin in the game or anything. Banks just want to see you doing the right things and following the right processes, because the entire business, the hard money business, the collateral is the property in all situations. That's why bank is protected, the investors are protected, everyone's money is protected by the property. And guess what? When you're investing in a debt fund, which actually goes on to become a hard money lender, that debt fund has rules and regulations that prohibit them from investing in a property or lending on a property more than 70%, including repairs. So, worst case scenario, if things were to go down, everybody gets a 70% clean deal back, or if it doesn't get sold at an auction. More than that. So that's why, I mean, people don't understand the whole mechanics of a hard money lender business. That's why people go on trying different things on their own, which is a lot more riskier and yields less returns when one thing goes wrong.
And when you're saying you're getting a nice clean 70% deal, you're talking about, not only do you not lend more than 70% loan to value on the as is value, but you also don't lend more than 70% of ARV for the total. What would that be, loan to cost?
anytime I say any percentage is based off of ARV. As a lender, your calculation should not be based on as-is value. Never. Because that doesn't mean anything to anybody. ARV is the only thing that is meaningful. As-is value can be different for me, different for you, and different for other people. People that base their opinion on as-is value have certain formula of their own. And that could be a different formula for different people. But I was saying the market value is the only ultimate standard. And 70% of the market value is pretty much the gold standard of hard money lenders that they don't like to exceed. There are some lenders that will make an exception based on your experience or the relationship and go up to 75 to 80, but I have not heard of anybody exceeding 80%.
Only private money investors do those deals, right? And at the end of the day, you know, as is value, who looks at as is value? Investors who are buying properties discounted. So lending, like I know we might have got a little bit sidetracked, but it would be nice to do an episode on why you invest your money with hard money lenders, because they look at so many things. Even though we lend money, we don't have our borrowers do appraisal. But at the back end, we are doing appraisal on every single property because it's our fiduciary responsibility towards our borrowers, not only our borrowers, because we should not be lending money for the deal if it's not appraised, but also our investors and at our banks. There are a lot of private money lenders lending to smaller mom and pop PMLs who do not have any red tapes. They don't check. There is no personal guarantees. There is no, you know, we have not had a borrower question personal guarantee once. So we can have one separate episode on why to lend money to hard money lenders and not PMLs. There are a lot of PMLs who are good who follow the same rule, not everybody, but I've seen a lot of the PMLs not doing their due diligence because whatever reason, right? They want to look more flexible and more sexy in the market that they just cut the checks. But, you know, at the end of the day, due diligence is very important when you're using whoever's money, right? Bank or private money or your own money.
I mean, if you are a PML and if you have attended our PML mastermind with Abraham and Alexis, and what we teach over there, again, I mean, you have seen that even with Alex, Abraham, we have a difference of opinion on a lot of things. And he has his style of teaching. And his style is more geared towards deploying your own capital. And our style is more geared towards building a hard money business. You should only learn deploying capital game if you want to eventually become a hard money lender. I don't even see the point of learning how to deploy the capital of your own if you don't have any aspirations to become the hard money lender. I mean, why learn something which hard money lenders can do that for you, which hard money lenders can do for you for free? They're already doing it. Just park your money with the hard money lender. It is so simple. But a lot of people want to learn a lot of mechanics behind things. So for education reasons, I get it. I mean, definitely you should try and learn everything about everything in real estate. But at the end of the day, if you want to take on PML as a business, I don't even understand the point of PML business if you don't plan on growing into a hard money lender. Really. That's just,
yeah, PML is the opinion,
but I just thought of it like for so many days after PML answering so many people's questions, and I'm like, why are these people learning to deploy their own capital and have no aspirations to become a hard money lender? I mean, where is this going? What is the end game here? So anyway, that's just my opinion.
Yeah, that's how we started as a PML, right? And then slowly moved into hard money lender. We could have institutional money. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to dig in really quickly. You said loan to value for you guys. You're saying that's loan to, and that's based off of ARV. I want to clarify something for the listeners, because I know that Abraham and Alexis are big on the loan to value, and the definition being that it's to as value. What is today's value of the property? So can you explain that a little bit clearer? What do you mean when you say that it's based off of ARV?
Are you asking me?
Yeah, go for that, Chai. Yeah.
No, so I was saying that ARV is the only ultimate standard, because ARV means market value, right? Market value when everything's fixed up after repair value, so then you can pull up your local MLS and look at that area and tell, okay, houses that look like this, that are equal age, equal square footage, equal lot size, are selling for $250,000. That is your ARV if you repair it all the way. Okay. But as is value, what is the definition of as is value? There is no definition of as is value. As is value is a value that you define for yourself. There is no market standard of it that I know of. I mean, there is a general understanding amongst investors of what amount or what formula you should buy, what formula you should be using to buy it. There is a general understanding or most common way or most commonly used formula out there, but there is no book definition of it. ARV has a definition in the book because appraisers use that definition, and appraisers use a comparable, like comp approach, basically, right? Comparable listings approach or whatever it's called.
For example, Justin, if me and Chai buy a property in your backyard, we don't have any crew, right? It's something that could take $5,000 to fix. It could cost us $15,000 to fix. So the as-is value for me and Chai is different than the as-is value for you, because you could fix something in $5,000 and it's going to take us $15,000 to fix it. And, you know, Abraham's and Alex's model is amazing because they work in their key Atlanta area, right? Abraham will buy the properties. So there, that if a borrower defaults, right? So there is different. We want to grow something, our business into it. If not nationwide, we want to be in multiple states. We are already in North Carolina and Texas. And we want to grow our business like 10 times of our holdings. So we don't want to be buying every property, because if we want to make this business.
We don't even want to be vetting every property. There has to be a standard, which is appraiser. That's what it's called.
Because once we get to a $50-100 million, we are not going to be able to buy all the properties, because at that point it's going to be a lot of money. Right. So we want it to be, if they come back, we want to get rid of it. You know, either foreclose on it, sell it to investors, and move on, because we treat that business as completely different business. It's a lending business, different than our acquisitions business. Our acquisitions buy boxes different than our lending buy box. Of course, we will buy some of them if they come back. We can, they are discounted, but we are not setting up our lending business where we could buy all of them.
Today we have set our lending box to match our buy box, because it's the easiest way to set the first, like, or put the first step towards the bigger goal. But the lending box and buy box, like Prakash said, is never gonna be in sync with each other, because lending box will change, because that is dependent on my definition of as is value. But lending box is never going to change, because that has to be tied to the gold standard of the market, which is appraisal. Because when I started lending in St. Joseph, Michigan, I don't live there. I've never visited the beautiful lake, or I don't know why the $1 million homes, I mean, why the homes are worth $1 million. So if I start defining based on my as is value definition, I'm not going to make any business there. I have to order an appraisal. I have to go off of ARV, the market value. So I don't know if that clarifies it.
Gotcha. Okay.
An amazing podcast idea based on this discussion.
Yeah, I think so. Because to me, it sounds different than what was taught at the Private Money Lending Mastermind, which is expansive perspective.
I do want to summarize a little bit. I don't want to just, I just don't want to sound like I'm trashing that idea of PML. Not at all. Okay. So PML is great where it is. It's a great way to get in the game. It's a great way to even run your business. And if you look at Abraham, who has large sums of money of his own, for that kind of person, who cares about banks $100 million when you have your own $100 million, right? So for that kind of person, that model is very suitable. And for his aspirations, and he can switch gears and go to banks and do bigger things within a heartbeat if he wanted to. But you and me and Prakash and Eric and all these people that are just getting into this world of real estate who don't have a $100 million to their name, for them, they just need to look at a bigger picture and ask yourself why you are in it. What is your end game? And someone might choose, like Eric. Eric is really fond of investors' money. I can feel it when I talk to him. And it should be. But he should remember, if he only goes after investor money, he is going to have to be happy with the small outlet that he's running. And it is going to have to be very specialized, specific, exclusive outlet. Because you are never going to be able to compete with a hard money lender. When hard money lenders slash their rates down, you cannot play that game. Because your money is going to be expensive than hard money lenders. Because you're paying an investor more than what a bank would pay. Right? So your money is automatically expensive. So as long as you understand what you're doing, then all education is great. And what we learned at PML is that's why they included us, because they wanted another mindset and another perspective for people to hear. Now that I'm breaking it down, I don't know how many people really grasped what we had to say at that time.
Because I think we exactly, Chai, what he broke down, it is not really different than what we had. We shared two strategies in the PML, right? What we tell people is what we have done from no money. Abraham's model is amazing. But remember, he's running his business from his $20 million that is not doing anything. As opposed to people like us, we just talked about putting 20% down on a house and then being all out of money. Right, so it's completely different, two different directions. You know, when I get to $20-30 million I have sitting in my bank, I might go that route, because then at that point I want to utilize my money first, which is in my bank, before using bank's money. Because that's what we do in our business. We don't use bank's money till we exhaust all our money, because we want to. That's where that business model is, right? Abraham, he wants to use all his money before he goes out.
Sure.
He goes to the bank.
Yeah. Well, this is great. Somewhat of complementary and competing worldviews in the space of investing. And so it's good, because, hopefully no one takes away, any kind of confusion, but is able to expand their mind to the possibilities beyond what they currently know, which at certain stages you know, we've got to be empowered with certain pieces of information. And then later on, there's a lot of other pieces of information we can learn and grow from. Yeah, this is great.
Yeah, to summarize, right, I think every hard money lenders also do things slightly different. We still go to hard money lenders meetings and learn from them, right? Nobody does it the wrong way. You only do it the wrong way when you're losing money. Everybody has to fine tune it based on what fits their business.
I mean, I met a guy at this Atlanta meetup that works with Abraham from time to time that has done $20 million worth of loans just by brokering it last year alone. I mean, he can come on your podcast and shit on hard money lenders. Like, why do you need to deal with banks when you can just pass the buck? Like, that's a good perspective. I mean,
yeah, it's more important to learn what people are doing successfully and implement what makes sense in your own business.
Absolutely. Yep. That's fantastic. Before we close, I do want to touch real quick. You obviously have had to build super strong relationships with the banks. And I know this could be a podcast probably in and of itself, but just if you could summarize just in a nutshell, what are some of the elements to building those kinds of relationships with the bank that lead to the kinds of credit lines you guys have gotten, which are, you know, upwards of 15, what, 20, 30? I don't know what you guys are up to at this point. Are you at 30 million now?
No, we're still at 27.
27. Oh.
27 darn. With promise and promise.
Only 27 million.
So, I mean, like, that's where we were. And honestly, we are working on marketing our business. We have more lines than more.
Approach and get bigger lines, but I mean, we don't want to sign the paperwork, because every time you sign the credit line paperwork, you end up paying upfront costs. So this is the, I mean, again, we don't need more than 27 right now.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, just to break that down, like what are some of the elements that are involved in building those relationships with the bank?
So, I mean, I would say the first and the most important thing to build that relationship is, I mean, learning what PML is, okay? It's very important. This game of lending, I cannot see anyone just winging it. It's impossible to wing this business. Like, you have to learn. Okay, a lot of people resist learning and try, I mean, they get by in most of the things they do in investing. Sometimes they will lose, but most of the times there is a support structure there. But you are committing to a lot more than you think in lending. So learning is very important, because banks are going to judge you based on your education and experience. Okay. And when you start learning, you realize that as a businessman, you need to be filing taxes. And I'm saying that on your podcast, especially because a lot of the people that we work with are rookies. I mean, nothing wrong with that. But as they grow in their career, they need to learn the importance of filing taxes. And in order to file taxes, their books have to be accurate. And in order for their books to be accurate, they need to have proper business accounts, proper segregation of funds, segregation of things. And that can only come from sitting down and breaking your business down in a spreadsheet, on a piece of paper, whatever your style is. So when you can break down your own business, you can explain that to the bank. If you can't even explain to the bank where your profit and loss is coming from, the banks will not even take another call from you. So it is so important to do your books right. Okay. And not just books right, you need to file your taxes and have everything updated quarterly. Again, for a few rental properties, a few PML deals here and there, it may feel like, oh, why do I need to do it? Maybe I'll do it at the end of the year. But when you go to the banks, you need to show that you have a process, because banks don't want to deal with an individual. Banks want to deal with a company. Like, company is bigger than a person running it. So the company is supposed to have its processes. And then on top of that, you should have done certain things on your own, raised money on your own, do things that require a business to grow before you have approached the bank. Like, bank is not going to say, okay, these are the prerequisites and you should first check these boxes, then you come to me. They are not going to, they are not in the business of educating you. Okay. You already need that education. You already need to know these things before you even approach the bank. Otherwise, bank's going to say, okay, let's chat next year and see where you are. Okay. Literally, because they guard their money very close to their chest. So, I mean, that's what I will say without going into too much details. This is the gist of what they want.
And, you know, banks want to work with people who are making money, right? We at least get a call once a week. Hey, why are you guys not finishing up the line that, you know, exhausting the line that we have given you guys? You might see me making posts. Hey, help me exhaust the line, right? It's like they're calling us and, hey, now we gave you the line. Like, it's an interesting relationship once it's established, right? They want to work with successful lenders, because they just, if they could hand you all the money and Justin will take care of it and they can go on vacation, that's the best thing for them, right? So they want to see that you're making money. They want to see that you've been doing it successfully. And as what Chai said, keep your books, make sure you maintain all the records and present that to the bank. They should be able to easily read what you're doing. They want all your accounting straight. There should be no commingling of, you know, personal stuff with business stuff. And they just want everything clean. At the end of the day, they're bankers, right?
I mean, that's where it starts. That doesn't get things done. That's where this will give you a meeting. That's it. After that, the real requirements will kick in.
Yeah, but all that pain is worth it, because once one bank gives you money, everybody, all the other banks in the market know, kind of, or we can just go to the other bank. Hey, we got the line from them. Are you willing to do something? So the due diligence for the other bank is much lower compared to the second bank. So, but if you go to one investor, he's going to give you 100, and then you talk to 100 more people, they're going to give you 10, 20, 30. But what you get from banks is a big chunk. And then once the bank, you know, gives you that blessing, it becomes a lot easier to raise private money, or it should, if you do a good job, if one does a good job of selling on how they're doing the business, because the blend is very important, as what Chai said. We need mix of both. It cannot just be one either or. But then the private money raising is only 10 to 15%, and the rest of the money will come from the bank.
So much potential when you're using money that isn't your own.
Yes.
Massive returns. Yeah. And we haven't even gotten into the valuation and sale of these things, but maybe we'll have you guys on again. We'll have to talk more in detail about this again.
Yes. Yeah, let's connect with, I know you guys are also doing very amazing. Eric's deals are like, you know, what we do in 20 deals, he has in one deal sometimes. Those are some amazing numbers.
Yeah, so but we're taking some of your advice and working to niche down into more scalable options. So, yeah.
I know Eric is already working with Stacy. Stacy is trying to get Eric's is all money as a deposit. I know Stacy, like, he likes deposits, right? And Eric has big deposits to give him. But I've told Eric, like, make sure he gets something against that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we're working on getting a bank account started there right now. So Fantastic. Well, Chai, Prakash, as always, really appreciate you guys. I appreciate all that you have, shared in my world, and the insights and the mentorship that you guys have given, and the ongoing value that you continue to bring. I just appreciate you both so much. Look forward to the many years ahead that we'll be able to do things together. I'm looking forward to seeing what we end up taking down in the next few years together. So
thank you for having us over. It was fun. And
yeah, it was so much fun talking about lending.
Yeah, it's same as it's very similar to our offline discussions that we have all the time.
Oh, heck yeah. Heck yeah. We'll just publicize this one.
Yes.
Fantastic. Well, to our listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, please like and subscribe and leave your thoughts in the comments below. Don't forget to join us every other Tuesday on Nursing Real Wealth for more inspiring stories and strategies to build wealth. Thank you and have a great day. God bless.